Chapter 7. The Bodhisattva Hierarchy. According to the Pali Canon, just after the Buddha became enlightened, or rather, while he was still exploring the different facets of that experience, which we usually refer to as though it were a single undifferentiated occurrence, he became aware of a very powerful aspiration. He knew that he had to find somebody or something that he could revere and respect. His fundamental impulse, it seems, so soon after his experience of enlightenment, was to reverence, to look up, not down. After some reflection, he realized that, having attained enlightenment, there was now no person he could look up to, because no one else had attained what he had attained. But he saw that he could look up to the Dharma, the great spiritual law by virtue of which he had attained enlightenment. He therefore decided to devote himself to reverencing the Dharma. This episode cannot be called to mind too often, especially because it is so contrary to the modern spirit of not wanting to honour or be indebted to anybody or anything. We are sometimes only too willing to look down on others, but we are unwilling to look up, and even feel resentful if others appear to be superior to us in any way. We are generally happy enough to admire and even venerate the superior physical strength, quickness of eye, and will to win of the athlete. But very often we are unwilling to respect or reverence qualities that are superior from a spiritual point of view. Someone once made the point that in any culture where a particular principle of is such fundamental importance that it is taken for granted, no word for that principle exists in the local language. One quite interesting reflection of this is to be found in the fact that in Buddhism there is no traditional term that corresponds to tolerance. It is though, in order to appreciate the tolerance of Buddhism, you have to be able to look at it from the standpoint of a tradition or culture that is not tolerant. Buddhism, traditionally, does not think of itself as tolerant. It doesn't promote that concept, doesn't recommend itself as being a tolerant religion. It has never attained that sort of self-consciousness with regard to its own nature. It is the same with hierarchy. Buddhism is traditionally saturated in it, to the extent that Buddhists are almost unable to step aside and see Buddhism as hierarchical. The very fact that the spiritual path consists of a series of steps or stages shows how deeply the hierarchical principle is embedded within Buddhism. In fact, the spiritual life itself is inseparable from the hierarchical principle. There is a hierarchy of wisdoms. The wisdom you hear or read about, Shrutamayi Pranya. The wisdom you cultivate through reflection, Chintamayi Pranya. And as the highest form, the wisdom cultivated in meditation, Bhavana Mayi Pranya. There is a hierarchy of the different levels of the cosmos, from the Karmaloka up to the Rupaloka and the Arupaloka. And of course there is a hierarchy of persons, both the Arya Pugalas of the Theravada and the Bodhisattvas of the Mahayana are organized into hierarchies. It would seem that the concept of hierarchy is absolutely fundamental to Buddhism. Without it, Buddhism as we know it can hardly exist. And for that very reason, perhaps, there is no traditional word or concept for hierarchy. There are certain words that express the idea of a sequence of increasing value within a particular context, but there is no overall generalized term covering all the different, more specific hierarchies. But when, as Westerners, we approach Buddhism from the outside, as it were, its hierarchical nature certainly strikes us, and some people have to struggle with this in a way that Eastern Buddhists with different cultural and psychological conditioning do not. After many years as a Buddhist myself, however, my own difficulty lies in trying to sympathize with the non- or anti-hierarchical concept of equality, which seems very limited and restricting. It would seem to me that inequality is one of the most obvious things about life. Of course, there are true hierarchies and false ones. In Europe in the 18th century, especially in France, the social and ecclesiastical hierarchy was completely false. It did not correspond to any facts or realities. For example, court favourites, with barely the faintest pretence to piety, were appointed to bishoprics. When the name of a certain courtier was proposed to Louis XV for Archbishop of Paris, he demurred. "No, no, the Archbishop of Paris should at least believe in God." Which shows how far things had gone. In the case of poor Louis XVI, who was guillotined, his real interest was in making locks, and that is what he spent most of his time doing. He had no idea about government. In other words, he wasn't really a king in the true sense of the word. Eventually, there was the great upheaval of the French Revolution, and the false hierarchy was overthrown in both church and state. But in negating the false hierarchy, people asserted not true hierarchy, but no hierarchy or anti-hierarchy. Hence the famous slogan, "Liberty, Equality, Fraternity." We have inherited a great deal from that period, politically, socially, intellectually, and spiritually. In particular, we have inherited an anti-hierarchical tendency, opposition not just to false hierarchies, but to hierarchies as such. That is unfortunate. One can understand people in revolutionary France being unable or unwilling to distinguish between genuine hierarchy and false hierarchy. They didn't want to give a false hierarchy any reason for existing at all. But in calmer times, we shouldn't have to reject the very idea of hierarchy in that way. It is sometimes said that everybody is as good as everybody else as a person. But this assumption is questionable. It is not as though the terms person and individual refer to something static. They suggest a degree of development, and some people are more developed than others. That is to say, some are better as persons or individuals than others. The point of such an assertion of hierarchy is not to put people in their place. Quite the opposite is true, because this hierarchy is not fixed. All that matters is that everybody should be encouraged to grow, and that none of us should accept some fixed idea of our value as individuals. Our value consists in the effort we make at the level we are at, rather than in some fixed position we hold in the hierarchy. If we have done our best, there can be no criticism of us. And it does seem that competition helps people give of their best, achieve their best, be their best. In one of his discourses, the Buddha spoke of each of his more intimate disciples in turn, declaring who was best at what. And it seems each of them could indeed be found to be the best at something or other. One was the best at giving talks, another was the best meditator, another was the best at going for alms. Everybody excelled at something. Still, the word hierarchy is very unpopular these days, and the dictionary definition, a body of ecclesiastical rulers, does nothing to make the term more appealing. But in its original sense, hierarchy means something like an embodiment in a number of different people, of different degrees of manifestation of reality. So one can speak, for instance, of a hierarchy of living forms, some lower, expressing or manifesting less reality, others higher, expressing or manifesting more reality. There is a continuous hierarchy of living forms, from amoebas right up to human beings. The higher the level, the greater the degree of reality. And there is another hierarchy of living forms, the hierarchy from the unenlightened human being right up to the enlightened Buddha. This corresponds to what in other contexts I have described as the higher evolution. Just as the unenlightened human being embodies or manifests more reality, more truth than the amoeba, in the same way, the enlightened human being embodies or manifests more reality in his or her life and work, and even speech, than does the unenlightened person. The enlightened person is like a clear window through which the light of reality shines, through which that light can be seen almost as it is. Or one can say that he or she is like a crystal or diamond, concentrating and reflecting that light. Between the unenlightened human being and the enlightened one, the Buddha, there are a number of intermediate degrees embodied in different people at different stages of spiritual enlightenment. Most people are still short of enlightenment, to a greater or lesser extent. But at the same time, they are not wholly unenlightened. They stand somewhere between the unenlightened state and the state of full enlightenment, and thus make up the spiritual hierarchy, the higher reaches of which can be referred to as the Bodhisattva hierarchy. By now we know enough about Bodhisattvas to have an appreciation of the intensity of their aspiration and commitment to the spiritual life. But even among Bodhisattvas, there are degrees of spiritual attainment. The principle of spiritual hierarchy is very important. As human beings, we are related to ultimate reality, both directly and indirectly. We are related to reality directly in the sense that in the very depths of our being is something which all the time connects us with reality, a kind of golden thread, which though it may be gossamer thin, is always there. In some people, that thread has become a little thicker, a little stronger. In others, it has strengthened almost into a rope. While in those who are enlightened, there is no need for a connecting thread at all, because there is no difference between the depth of their being and the depth of reality itself. So we are directly connected in the depth of our being with reality, although most of us don't realize it. Though we don't see that thin golden thread shining in the midst of the darkness within us, nevertheless it is there. We are related indirectly to reality in two ways. In the first place, we are related to those things that represent a lower degree of manifestation of reality than ourselves. We are related to nature, rocks, water, fire, the different forms of vegetable life, and the forms of animal life that are lower on the scale of evolution than ourselves. This relationship may be compared with seeing a light through a thick veil. Sometimes the veil seems to be so thick, especially in the case of material forms, that we are unable to see the light at all. We are indirectly related to reality also through those forms that represent a higher degree of manifestation of reality than ourselves. This is like seeing a light through a thin veil, a veil that seems at times as fine as gossamer, and even just occasionally parts and falls away to allow the light of reality to be seen directly, as it is, without any mediation at all. We could say that this thin veil, through which we see the light of reality, is the spiritual hierarchy, especially the Bodhisattva hierarchy. It is of the utmost importance for us to be in contact with people who are at least a little more spiritually advanced than we are ourselves, through whom the light of reality shines a little more clearly than it shines through us. Such people are known traditionally in Buddhism as our spiritual friends, our Kalyana Mitras, and they are more important to us than even a Buddha would be. If we happened to have the opportunity to meet a Buddha, we probably wouldn't be able to make much of the encounter or even realize the nature of the person in front of us. We are likely to benefit much more from contact with those who are just a little more spiritually developed than we are. In this connection, there is a beautiful passage in that great Tibetan spiritual classic, The Jewel Ornament of Liberation of Gampopa. Speaking of spiritual friends, Gampopa says, "Since at the beginning of our career, it is impossible to be in touch with the Buddhas or with Bodhisattvas living on a high level of spirituality, we have to meet with ordinary human beings as spiritual friends. As soon as the darkness caused by our deeds has lightened, we can find Bodhisattvas on a high level of spirituality. Then, when we have risen above the great preparatory path, we can find the Nimanakaya of the Buddha. Finally, as soon as we live on a high spiritual level, we can meet with the Sambhogakaya as a spiritual friend. Should you ask, who among these four is our greatest benefactor? The reply is that in the beginning of our career, when we are still living imprisoned by our deeds and emotions, we will not even see so much as the face of a superior spiritual friend. Instead, we will have to seek an ordinary human being who can illumine the path we have to follow with the light of his counsel, whereafter we shall meet superior ones. Therefore, the greatest benefactor is a spiritual friend in the form of an ordinary human being." This association with spiritual friends is what the Indians called satsang, and they attach tremendous importance to it. Satsang is a Sanskrit word, though it is used in modern Indian languages too, which is made up of two parts: sat, meaning good, true, right, real, genuine, holy, spiritual, and sang, meaning association, company, fellowship, community, even communion. So satsang means good fellowship, communion with the good, or holy association. The importance of satsang has been stressed in India down the centuries because we do all need help in leading the spiritual life. We can't get far on our own. If, week after week, year after year, we had no meditation classes to go to, if we never met another person who was interested in Buddhism, if we couldn't even get any books, because reading books of the right kind is also a sort of satsang, if we were entirely on our own, we wouldn't get far, however great our initial enthusiasm and sincerity. We get encouragement, inspiration, and moral support from associating with others who have similar ideals and who are following a similar way of life. This is especially the case when we associate with those who are a bit more spiritually advanced than we are, or to put it more simply, who are just a bit more human than most people are, a bit more aware, a bit kinder, a bit more faithful, and so on. In practice, this means that we should try to be open and receptive towards those whom we can recognize to be above us in the spiritual hierarchy. Those who clearly have greater insight, understanding, sympathy, compassion, and so on. We should be ready to receive from them, just as a flower opens its petals to receive the light and warmth of the sun. As for those who are, as far as we can tell, and bearing in mind we might be mistaken, below us in the spiritual hierarchy, our attitude should be one of generosity, kindliness and helpfulness, giving them encouragement, making them feel welcome, and so on. And with regards to those who seem to be roughly on the same level as ourselves, our attitude should be one of mutuality, sharing, reciprocity. These three attitudes correspond to the three great positive emotions of the Buddhist spiritual life. First of all, there is Shraddha. This is often translated as faith or belief, but it really means a sort of devotion, a receptivity to the light streaming down, as it were, from above. Secondly, there is compassion, which is a giving out of what we have received from above to those who are lower in the spiritual hierarchy. And thirdly, there is love, or metta, which we share with all those who are on the same level as ourselves. In the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, Gampopa goes on to say, "The enlightenment of a Buddha is obtained by serving spiritual friends." A strong statement, to say the least, and possibly not a palatable one. The whole idea of service is rather alien to us. We are familiar with the idea of devoting ourselves to caring for our children, perhaps, or looking after our parents when they are old. But it is not always easy for us to transpose that feeling to other situations. This is very much connected with the collapse of the idea of spiritual hierarchy, or any kind of hierarchy. If we are all equal, why should you do something for someone else? Why shouldn't he or she do it for you? Or why can't you do it on an exchange basis? I'll do it for you today if you do it for me tomorrow. To put oneself in the position of serving someone is to acknowledge that the person one is serving is better than oneself in some respects. It is this that many people are unwilling to do. But unless one can make that acknowledgement, one cannot grow spiritually. In serving spiritual friends, one grows to become more like them, and then one finds that there are other spiritual friends to be served. Even when one becomes an advanced bodhisattva, one finds that the universe is full of Buddhas to whom one can give devoted service. There is always someone one can serve. Gampopa also says that one should think of a spiritual friend as the Buddha. The idea of this is not to burden one's friend, as an ordinary human being, with the idea that he or she is a Buddha, or try to convince oneself that they are a Buddha when one's reason tells one that they are not. One need not regard everything that they do or say as the action of a Buddha. What is more important is that while one's spiritual friend may be very far from being a Buddha, he or she is at least a little more spiritually developed than one is oneself. It's as though behind one's friend stands his or her own teacher, and behind that teacher another one, back and back, until behind them all stands the Buddha. So the Buddha is shining, as it were, through all these people who are of varying degrees of translucency. At least, this is one way of interpreting the advice to think of a spiritual friend as the Buddha. However, Gampopa, who belonged primarily to the Tantric tradition, being a guru of the Kagyu school of Tibet, as well as one of Milarepa's main disciples, might well have intended this statement to be taken quite literally. Fundamental to the Vajrayana is the idea that each of the three jewels has its esoteric aspect. And esoteric as it is, this notion is a profoundly practical one. The Vajrayanis said, in effect, that the Buddha's enlightenment, his teaching of the truth he had discovered, and the growth of the circle of his enlightened followers, these three jewels, which have been revered down the ages of Buddhist tradition, all happened a very long time ago. We ourselves can have no direct contact with them, and cannot benefit from their direct influence. We have to find, in effect, our own three jewels. The question is where to find them. The answer the Vajrayana came up with was that one should regard one's Dharma teacher, one's guru, as the Buddha, the exemplar of enlightenment as far as one is personally concerned. Similarly, one should see one's Yidam, the Buddha or Bodhisattva, upon whom one meditates, as the embodiment of the truth itself. And the esoteric Sangha refuge is the company of Dakinis, with whom, according to Vajrayana tradition, one can be in living contact. In one's own particular context, The guru or teacher stands for the Buddha, and even, in the tantric context, is a Buddha. Another way of approaching Gampopa's maxim is to reflect on the teaching that every human being is potentially a Buddha. According to some Buddhist schools, if one could only look hard enough, one would see that every human being is in fact a Buddha, whether they realize it or not. In the case of a spiritual friend, since he or she has become at least a little Buddha-like, it is easier to see in him or her the fundamental Buddha nature that we all possess. Gampopa goes on to recommend not just that we should serve our spiritual friends, but that we should please them. That is, we should give them cause to rejoice in the qualities they perceive developing in us. If you please a spiritual friend, and they please you, both of you will be in this state of sympathetic joy, mudita, and communication will be established and will flow. They will be able to teach and you to learn. In an interesting passage in the great chapter of the Sutta Nipata, a certain Brahmin is not sure whether the Buddha is in fact the Buddha, the enlightened one, or whether he is just a great man, a superman, or Mahapurissa. But it seems that this Brahmin has heard of a way to find out. He has heard that the Buddhas reveal their true self, their true nature, if they are praised. Praising is related to pleasing, a sort of pleasing in words. If you praise a Buddha, he cannot but show his true nature. And conversely, even a Buddha cannot show his true nature unless the situation is positive enough to allow him to do so. It is much the same on another level with a spiritual friend. To please him or her is to make communication more effective, whereas to displease him or her is to set up a barrier to communication. Pleasing here doesn't mean gratifying someone's ego, but relating to them in an open, free, sincere, genuine, and warm way, showing metta, sympathetic joy, that is, joy in the virtues of others, and equanimity. If you please a spiritual friend, it makes it easier for them to communicate with you, for their true nature to emerge. And you are the one who benefits from that. It is you who gains in the long run. Although I have referred to those who are higher up and those who are lower down, there is no question of any official grading. If we start even thinking in terms of being higher or lower than other people, we have failed to grasp the nature of spiritual hierarchy. Everything should be natural and spontaneous. The appropriate emotion, whether of devotion, compassion, or love, should flow forth unselfconsciously and spontaneously in response to whomsoever we meet. I used to go with Tibetan friends, both lamas and lay people, to visit monasteries and temples, and it was interesting to see their responses when they entered such places. When we in the West go to a place of worship, a great cathedral or something like that, we may not know quite what to do, how to respond, what to feel. But when I used to visit temples with my Tibetan friends, there was none of that sort of confusion or inner conflict. As soon as they saw an image of the Buddha, one could almost see the feelings of devotion and faith and reverence welling up within them. They put their hands to their foreheads and often prostrated themselves flat on the ground 3 times. They did this completely unselfconsciously. It was natural to them because of the context in which they had grown up, a context which has now, of course, largely been shattered. It is this kind of spontaneous emotion that creates the spiritual hierarchy, a spontaneous feeling of devotion when one encounters something higher, a spontaneous overflowing of compassion when one is confronted by other people's distress or difficulty, and a spontaneous welling up of love and sympathy when one is among one's peers. These are the emotions that should influence the whole Buddhist community. People in such a community are like roses in different stages of growth, all blooming on a single bush, or like a spiritual family in which the Buddha is the head and the great bodhisattvas the elder brothers and sisters. In such a family, everybody gets what they need. The younger people are cared for by the older ones. Everybody gives what they can, and the whole family is pervaded by a spirit of joy, freedom, warmth and light. The bodhisattva hierarchy concentrates all this into a single focal point of dazzling intensity. It has its own degrees, its own radiant figures, at higher and ever higher stages of spiritual development, right up to Buddhahood itself. According to the Mahayana, the bodhisattva path is divided up into 10 progressive stages, the 10 bhumis, bhumi meaning a stage of progress, each representing an increasing degree of manifestation of the bodhicitta. The scriptures say that the progressive manifestation of the bodhicitta through the 10 bhumis is like gold mixed with dross being gradually smelted, refined, and made into a beautiful ornament, like a crown for the head of a prince. The gold is, of course, the bodhicitta, which is within us all the time, but adulterated, overwhelmed, or smothered by all sorts of adventitious defilements and murkiness. The gold is pure in itself, but the defilements have gradually to be purged away to allow the bodhicitta to manifest its own incorruptible nature. There are four kinds of bodhisattva who make up the bodhisattva hierarchy. Novice bodhisattvas, bodhisattvas of the path, irreversible bodhisattvas, and bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya. Novice bodhisattvas are sometimes called bodhisattvas in precepts. Among their number are all those who genuinely accept the bodhisattva ideal, the ideal of attaining enlightenment not just for the sake of one's own individual emancipation, but as a way of contributing to the enlightenment of sentient beings everywhere. This acceptance goes very deep. Novice bodhisattvas are not just those who have read a book about Mahayana Buddhism and understand the bodhisattva ideal. They are not even just those who have taken the bodhisattva ordination, who have formally and publicly pledged themselves to the fulfillment of the bodhisattva ideal. They are those who are fully, from the bottom of their hearts, devoted to the realization of the bodhisattva ideal and are making a tremendous effort to practice it. But if one is a novice bodhisattva, despite one's heartfelt acceptance of the bodhisattva ideal and one's strong efforts to practice it, the bodhicitta has not yet arisen within one. One has not felt, as an overwhelming experience, the urge to universal enlightenment for the sake of all living beings, taking complete possession of one's entire being. One could perhaps say, and this is not meant unkindly, that as a novice bodhisattva, one is a bodhisattva in every respect, except the one that is most important. One has all the rest of the equipment, but the bodhicitta itself, the will to enlightenment as a direct, dynamic experience, has not yet arisen. At the same time, one has certainly set foot on the path. Most sincere followers of the Mahayana fall into this category. As a novice bodhisattva, one devotes a great deal of time to studying the Mahayana scriptures, especially those that deal with emptiness, with the bodhisattva ideal, and with the paramitas. Not that one necessarily reads a great many books. One may read just a few volumes or even just a few pages, but one reads them again and again, soaking oneself in the spirit of these texts, trying to absorb them, to allow the teaching to fill one's heart and mind. It is traditional in many parts of the Mahayana Buddhist world for the novice bodhisattva to learn these profound scriptures by heart and repeat them from time to time, especially at the beginning or end of a meditation. Another traditional practice for the novice bodhisattva is simply making copies of the scriptures. This isn't just a way of reproducing the text. The idea is that it is a meditation in itself. One has to concentrate in order to form the letters beautifully, not missing out any words or making any spelling mistakes. At the same time, one is thinking of the meaning of the words, so that at least something of that meaning is percolating through, sinking drop by drop into the depths of one's unconscious mind, quietly influencing and transforming one's being. Traditionally, great importance is attached to the copying and illuminating of texts, just as in the Middle Ages in Europe, monks spent many hours illuminating manuscripts, burnishing them with gold, and decorating them with beautiful pictures and designs. All this studying and learning by heart and making of copies is done as a labour of love, a sadhana, a spiritual discipline. As a novice bodhisattva, one meditates, of course, and one meditates especially on the four Brahma-viharas, developing towards all sentient beings loving-kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. These practices are especially important because, so it is said, they form the foundation later on of the great compassion that characterizes the fully developed bodhisattva. The next step is to direct one's attention to the practice of the perfections. And of course, one performs every day, if possible, the sevenfold puja. One also cultivates the four factors that support the arising of the bodhicitta, as taught by Vasubandhu, and one tries to be straightforward, helpful, friendly, and sympathetic in all the affairs of daily life. This is the novice bodhisattva, one who is deeply committed to and sincerely practices the bodhisattva ideal, but in whom the bodhicitta has not yet arisen. At the next level are the bodhisattvas of the path, that is, those who are in the process of traversing the first six of the 10 bhumis. All bodhisattvas of the path have experienced the awakening of the bodhi heart, either before or upon attaining the first bhumi, and they have also made their bodhisattva vows and begun the serious practice of the paramitas. In many Mahayana traditions, the stream entrant, the once returner, the non-returner, and the arhant of the Theravada teaching are all regarded as bodhisattvas of the path. They are made honorary bodhisattvas, as it were. From the Mahayana point of view, though they have all so far been aiming for individual enlightenment, they can change over at any time. Even if one has progressed along the path of individual emancipation as far as it goes, one may at that point see the possibility of rising to the level of enlightenment for the sake of all. Then, on the basis of one's previous practice of the individual path, one can take up the bodhisattva path. In the Jewel Ornament of Liberation, quoting the Akshayamati Paripracha Sutra, Gampopa describes the progress of bodhisattvas of the path as follows. Benevolence with reference to sentient beings is found in bodhisattvas who have just formed an enlightened attitude. With reference to the nature of the whole of reality in bodhisattvas who live practicing good, and without reference to any particular object in bodhisattvas who have realized and accepted the fact that all entities of reality have no origin. The fact that benevolence with reference to sentient beings is found in bodhisattvas who have just formed an enlightened attitude, by which Gampopa means those in whom the bodhicitta has arisen, perhaps suggests how difficult it is to develop such benevolence. When one has at least a reasonably constant attitude of goodwill towards other sentient beings, one is virtually a bodhisattva, it would seem, or a stream entrant in Theravada terms. And this shows how hugely important it is to be positive towards others, in spite of all their failings and one's own, and all the complications that arise therefrom to test one's patience. Then, according to Gampopa, bodhisattvas of the path are capable of benevolence with reference to the whole of reality. As a novice bodhisattva, you will have been developing metta towards all sentient beings, while still feeling that they are separate from yourself. But as a bodhisattva of the path, you begin to overcome that feeling of separateness. It isn't that everything is reduced to a monistic metaphysical oneness, but the sense of difference and separateness definitely lessens. This is difficult to describe in words, which inevitably derive from dualistic experience, but it is as though the experience of self and others begins to be permeated by something that transcends both without cancelling or negating either on its own level. The distinction is no longer absolute. The tension, so to speak, between self and others is lessened, being contained within a wider framework of reality. For instance, with regard to the practice of giving, at the elementary or novice level, there might be a degree of conflict. Shall I take this for myself, or shall I give it to that other person? Eventually, with a tremendous effort, one may decide to be noble and give it away. But once one has developed this second level of benevolence, that conflict no longer exists. One sees that whether one takes something for oneself or gives it away makes no real difference, so one can just give the thing away quite freely and happily. As for benevolence without reference to any particular object, in bodhisattvas who have realized and accepted the fact that all entities of reality have no origin, this occurs in the 8th of the 10 bodhisattva bhumis. This is anuttapatthika dharmakashanti, the patient acceptance that dharmas do not in reality arise or pass away. In other words, one sees that in reality there is no conditionality, no causality, and one is able to face up to this fact, even though it goes against all one's suppositions. One sees the whole of existence as being like a mirage, not really coming into existence, and therefore not really going out of existence either. What seals the genuine mystery of this realization is that one is all the more compassionate for it. So the third level of the bodhisattva hierarchy involves not so much a further step as a complete overturning of one's experience. All the normal signposts to one's experience, one's familiar ways of looking at things, are transcended, and one's compassion becomes very difficult to describe, because one sees the whole of existence in a completely different way. The categories of self and others have become like a dream, a mirage. Above all, one's further spiritual progress is assured. Beyond the arising of the bodhicitta is this point upon which the whole of the spiritual life, viewed according to whatever perspective, turns. Anyone who has tried to live a spiritual life knows how difficult it is to make even a little progress. We may look back somewhat sadly over the months or years, thinking, there hasn't been all that much change. I'm still more or less the same person I used to be. Progress on the path is measured by inches, one might say. And even then, it is all too easy to slip by yards if one drops one's meditation practice or loses touch with one's spiritual friends. When our meditation practice intensifies, it can take just a couple of days without meditating to put us, as it seems, as soon as we sit down to meditate again, right back where we were months before. Of course, we have not literally gone back to where we were before. Indeed, it would be impossible for us to do so. And sometimes we may need to withdraw in order to move forward again, more wholeheartedly. But anybody who meditates regularly will have this experience of finding that they have lost their edge from time to time. The danger of falling back applies at all levels of the spiritual life. It is therefore crucial that we should reach a point beyond which we will be safe from backsliding. We need to reach firm ground. Hence the importance of irreversibility. It is found in the very earliest Buddhist texts, for example in the Dhammapada, which says, "That enlightened one whose victory is irreversible," literally, "whose conquest cannot be conquered or be made a non-conquest, and whose sphere endless, by what track will you lead him astray, the trackless one?" What does this mean? According to Buddhist tradition, our mundane experience naturally consists in action and reaction between opposite factors, pleasure and pain, love and hatred, and so on. Upon taking up the spiritual life, which in this context means becoming a novice bodhisattva, you get the same process of interaction between factors, but one factor augments rather than opposes the other. One traditional description of this process is in terms of the sequence of positive nidanas or links, awareness of the inherently unsatisfactory nature of existence, in dependence upon which arises faith, then joy, rapture, bliss, calm, meditative concentration, and knowledge and vision of things as they really are. However, although this sequence is progressive or spiral, rather than cyclical, it is reversible. You can revert back through the sequence until you are back where you started. It's a bit like playing snakes and ladders. So the crucial point of the spiritual life is the point at which one passes from this skillful but reversible state to a state that is irreversible. This is the point of insight, the point at which one enters the stream, the point at which, in terms of the sequence outlined above, one gains knowledge and vision of things as they really are. This is the real object of the spiritual life. There is no need to think in terms of enlightenment or Buddhahood. That is simply the inevitable culmination of the irreversible sequence of skillful mental states that ensues from insight. Once you have entered the stream, you are irreversibly bound for enlightenment, one could say. You have sufficient spiritual momentum to take you all the way. You may still have a long way to go, but you are now safe from any danger of losing what you have gained. It is therefore said of the Buddha's victory, his attainment of enlightenment, that it is irreversible, it cannot be undone. There is no outside power that can make a Buddha no longer a Buddha. This applies not only to the Buddha, but also to the Arhant, the once returner, and the stream entrant, and of course the irreversible Bodhisattva. But until we have passed through that gate of irreversibility, we are in a precarious position. This is why we need to make a constant effort in our spiritual life, and also make sure that we are living and working in conditions that support our spiritual efforts. Until we have reached that point of no return, we need the most positive situation, the most helpful environment we can possibly get. This is what the Buddha was getting at in his last words. Appamādana sampedata, which can be translated, "with mindfulness strive." To reach the point of irreversibility, one has to go on making an effort, including the effort to be mindful and aware enough to ensure that the conditions one lives in are conducive to one's making the best effort one possibly can. One can make a great deal of effort, but if it does not include an effort to create more favourable conditions, one is almost wasting one's energy. On the other hand, one can be in the most favourable conditions imaginable, but if one is not making an effort, what use are those conditions? Both are necessary. Many people become aware of the effect of positive conditions when they go on retreat for the first time. The degree to which one can change in the course of just a few days is remarkable. Just leaving the city and staying in the country, being undisturbed by the pull of trivial distractions, and doing a bit more meditation and Dharma study than you usually have time for, can transform you into quite a different person, much happier and more positive. So it isn't enough to try to change one's mental state through meditation. One needs the cooperation of one's environment. Without this, it is very difficult, even impossible, to develop spiritually up to the point of irreversibility. This fundamental concept of irreversibility, the point at which one's commitment to the spiritual path is so strong that no conditions can sway it, has been lost sight of to some extent, both in the Theravada and in the Mahayana. This is a pity. No doubt it is good to have the concept of enlightenment before us, but it needs to be brought down to earth, and thinking in terms of stream entry, in the broad sense, not in the narrow sense, which opposes it to the Bodhisattva ideal, helps us to do that, reminds us that we cannot afford to slacken off our spiritual effort until we have reached the point of irreversibility. In terms of the Arhant path, one becomes irreversible at the point of stream entry. But on the Bodhisattva path, while the Bodhicitta arises at the level of the first bhumi, the movement towards irreversibility takes place somewhere between the sixth bhumi, Abhimukhi, or the face-to-face, and the seventh, Durangama, or far-going, while in the eighth bhumi, Achala, the immovable one, one is established in the state of irreversibility. If the arising of the bodhicitta corresponds roughly to stream entry, bearing in mind that the concepts of the bodhicitta and stream entry come from entirely different schemata, how can these two concepts of irreversibility be reconciled? If transcendental insight is something one cannot lose, how is it possible to fall back from the bodhicitta? Traditional Mahayana thinking, which regards the arising of the bodhicitta as occurring further along the spiritual path than stream entry, would say that in the case of stream entry, one's irreversibility represents the fact that one cannot again be reborn in lower levels of existence, in a state of suffering, as a preta, a hell being, or an animal. One is guaranteed rebirth as a human being, and sure to make further spiritual progress. Then, later in one's spiritual life, the bodhicitta arises. One is no longer thinking in terms of arhantship, as one was when one entered the stream. One is now thinking in terms of supreme Buddhahood. So one progresses further and further along the path, until one becomes irreversible from that goal. Until then, one can still fall back from the goal of supreme Buddhahood to the goal of arhantship. This is to look at these three stages as constituting successive stages of development along a single path. But from our standpoint, we are in a position to try to see what the two traditions have in common, what they are both essentially concerned with. If we draw things together in that way, we can see the stream entry of the Theravada as corresponding to irreversibility within the Mahayana context. There is no question of the Bodhisattva's irreversibility being further along the path than the Arhant stream entry. It is simply a more open-ended version of stream entry, one could say. Or to put it another way, the concept of stream entry is a narrower version of the goal the Buddha taught, the goal the Mahayana was trying to get back to. So broadly speaking, although stream entry as formulated by the early Buddhist schools and irreversibility as formulated by the Mahayana are different from each other when viewed in terms of the context within which they developed, They are in fact concerned with the same thing. If we see that each is a historical development, we can dispense with any idea that there is really a path of individual enlightenment, or that the development of compassion is a separate stage further along the path. According to Theravada teaching, stream entry is achieved by breaking the first three of the 10 fetters that are said to bind us to the wheel of life. The first of these fetters is belief in self, the belief that I am fixed and final. It includes the conviction that there is no such thing as universal consciousness, absolute reality, outside oneself. Bound by this fetter, we think that we ourselves are the point upon which all ends of the world are come, to echo a famous description of the Mona Lisa, that our personal individual existence is irreducible and ultimate. If we examine our experience closely, we will see that this is how we feel most of the time. Sometimes a chink is made, sometimes we see something greater than ourselves, but usually we believe in ourselves in this narrow, limited, egoistic sense, as identified with the body and the lower mind. We are blind to any higher vision, any more ultimate selfhood, any more universal mind or consciousness. This belief in self in this sense is a fetter that has to be broken before we can enter the stream and break through into a higher, wider dimension of being and consciousness. There are different ways of looking at insight experiences, but the Theravada conception of the breaking of fetters provides us with a standard by which to measure our progress. If we are still thinking very much in terms of me, myself, and I, clearly we haven't developed much in the way of insight. As insight develops, we make a transition from the conditioned to the unconditioned, loosening the ties or fetters that bind us to the conditioned. The second fetter is doubt, not in the sense of objective, cool, critical inquiry, which is actually the sort of doubt that Buddhism encourages, but a soul-corroding unease that won't settle down in anything, that is full of fears and humours and whimsicalities, that won't be satisfied, that doesn't want to know and shies away from knowing, that won't try to find out and then complains that it doesn't know. This sort of doubt, vichikitsa, as it is called, is another strong fetter that must be broken for stream entry to be possible. The third fetter is dependence on moral rules and religious observances. If we are too moral, in other words, we cannot become enlightened. Which is not to say, of course, that if we are immoral, we gain enlightenment more easily. But if we think a lot of ourselves on account of our being good, holy and pure, if we think we've really got somewhere, and that those who do not do what we do ourselves, do not keep the rules we keep, are nowhere in comparison, we are in the grip of this fetter. Jesus said that the Sabbath was made for man, and not man for the Sabbath. But his most fervent followers are apt to forget that no religious observance is an end in itself. And more or less the same point, represented by this fetter, apparently tends to be lost on Buddhists just as easily. For example, in Burma, there was a long-running dispute as to whether, when a monk went out of the monastery, he should cover his shoulder or leave it bare. It split the whole of the Burmese Sangha for a century. Books and articles and pamphlets and commentaries were written about it, and even now it has only been settled in the sense that the parties have agreed to differ. This is no more than an extreme example of dependence upon moral rules and religious observances as ends in themselves. Something may be good as a means to an end. Meditation is good, an ethical life is good, giving is good, studying the scriptures is good. But as soon as it is set up as an end in itself, it becomes a hindrance. And of course, This almost inevitably does happen if you apply yourself to these practices with any enthusiasm. So this fetter is very difficult indeed to break. You can't do it by giving up rules, rituals, and religious observances. You do it by following them wholeheartedly but without attachment, i.e. as a means to an end. In the meantime, this fetter is a reminder that there is no safe way of practicing the Dharma. It is dangerous to practice the precepts, for example, in the sense that there is the possibility of practicing them wrongly. To ask for a completely safe practice is to ask for a practice in which attitude doesn't matter, a practice which is always sure to be the right thing to do. But that is impossible. Attitude always counts. Where there is a possibility of skillfulness, there is also a possibility of unskillfulness, until such a time as one is a stream entrant. One can do puja in an unskillful state of mind or for unskillful reasons. One can go on retreat for the wrong reasons. One can read Buddhist books for the wrong reasons. One can go on pilgrimage for the wrong reasons. One can adopt a wrong attitude of mind towards one's meditation practice, thinking that it makes one better than other people. In short, it is possible to be a Buddhist for entirely the wrong reasons. There is no practice which is entirely safe from a spiritual point of view. It is said of these three fetters that once one has broken any one of them, the others break too. So once one has fully transcended a belief in oneself, as one now experiences that self, as something fixed and final, or once one has overcome doubt, or once one is able to follow moral rules and religious observances without attachment, at that point one enters the stream. Even though one has broken through the fetter of self-view in becoming a stream entrant, nonetheless a subtle I sense persists. Otherwise one would be completely enlightened. That subtle I sense is represented by the fetter of conceit, the eighth fetter, which is broken, according to the Pali scriptures, only when one becomes an arahant. Clearly there is a possibility of subtle spiritual individualism, even after stream entry. It could be that the more advanced teachings pertaining to shunyata help one to resolve that, but they should be marked for stream entrance only. For the Mahayana, of course, there is a further point of no return beyond the Theravada conception of stream entry. If you are a bodhisattva, you have already passed the point of no return represented by stream entry, but you are always in danger of falling away from the bodhisattva ideal up to the eighth bhumi. Only then do you become an irreversible bodhisattva. So there is a long way to go. Up to that point, there is always the danger, not of falling away from the spiritual life, that danger has been overcome long ago, but of falling back into spiritual individualism. The danger is that you will give up trying to become enlightened for all and just seek to gain enlightenment for your own sake. After all, if you take it seriously, you have to recognize that the bodhisattva ideal is extremely challenging. You are aspiring to gain enlightenment for the sake of all living beings, to feel compassion for all living beings. That is your bodhisattva vow. At the same time, obviously, you are in contact only with a minute fraction of them, and to feel compassion even for the people one meets is difficult enough. People, it has to be said, can be very trying, foolish, weak, and misguided. So even the bodhisattva of the path, right up to the eighth bhumi, may be tempted sometimes to give up on people in despair. One may end up thinking, I just can't do anything for them. Well, never mind. I'll get on with my own emancipation. Let them do as they like. And having given up the goal of universal enlightenment, one might even achieve individual emancipation, arhantship, nirvana. But in relation to one's original goal, this would represent a falling away, a failure. For the bodhisattva, one could say, nirvana is a failure, which just goes to show how high the ideal is. So how does the bodhisattva become irreversible? This probably won't concern us personally for a long while, but at least let us see what the scriptures have to say. Broadly speaking, the bodhisattva becomes irreversible through the realization of great emptiness. As we have seen, this is essentially a realization of the emptiness of the distinction between the conditioned and the unconditioned. When the experience of great emptiness dawns, one sees clearly that while the distinction between the two may be useful for practical purposes, it is not ultimately valid. When one goes deeply into the conditioned, one encounters the unconditioned. And when one goes deeply into the unconditioned, one encounters the conditioned. Spiritual individualism is based on dualistic thinking, on the idea that there is an unconditioned up there or out there to which one can aspire as a kind of escape from the conditioned. But when you realize great emptiness, you see that it is not so. You see that all talk of conditioned and unconditioned, all talk of getting from here to there, is unreal. Likewise, deciding whether to go by yourself or with others, whether to come back or stay there, is a game, a dream, a make-believe. You awake from the dream of dualistic thinking into the light, the reality of the one mind, the non-dual mind, the non-dual reality, whatever you want to call it. You see that in its ultimate depths, the conditioned is the unconditioned. In the words of the Heart Sutra, Rupa is Shunyata and Shunyata is Rupa. There is nothing to escape from and nowhere to escape to. You also see the utter absurdity of the very idea of individual emancipation. It is this realization that makes the bodhisattva irreversible. He or she cannot fall back to the individual emancipation because there is no individual emancipation to fall back to. If one is curious to know whether one has reached the point of irreversibility, the Perfection of Wisdom scriptures suggest various ways of telling. They say that if one is an irreversible bodhisattva, when one is asked about the nature of the ultimate goal, one speaks not just in terms of nirvana or individual emancipation, one always includes a reference to the compassionate aspect of the spiritual life in one's reply. In this way, one is known to be irreversible, whether or not one has studied the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. Also, one has all sorts of archetypal dreams. In these dreams, you may see yourself as a Buddha preaching the Dharma, surrounded by bodhisattvas, or practicing the paramitas. In particular, you may see yourself sacrificing your life, maybe having your head cut off and feeling quite happy about it. These are other signs that one has become irreversible. And finally, a telling sign of irreversibility is that if you are an irreversible bodhisattva, it never occurs to you to wonder whether or not you are an irreversible bodhisattva. With the fourth and highest level of the hierarchy, the level of the bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya, we find ourselves on a wholly transcendental plane, beyond thought, and, one would think, beyond words too. But paradoxically, Buddhism is very rich in words for ultimate reality. In English we have reality, truth, the absolute. But there are many Pali and Sanskrit terms, each with its own special flavour, its own shade of meaning. The word Dharmakaya is one of those words. People usually translate it as body of truth, and more or less leave it at that. But body of truth conveys nothing of the true nature of the Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya means, as far as it can be put into a few words, ultimate reality as the constitutive essence of Buddhahood and Bodhisattvahood, as the fountainhood of enlightened being and enlightened personality, from which Buddha and Bodhisattva forms come welling up inexhaustibly. We will be looking at the Dharmakaya in the context of the Mahayana's Trikaya doctrine in the next chapter. Bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya are of two kinds. One may say, bearing in mind that at this transcendental level, one can't really speak in terms of differences or kinds at all. The first consists of those bodhisattvas who, after becoming Buddhas, retain their bodhisattva forms so that they can continue working in the world. At least, this is the matter viewed in quite exoteric terms. According to Tibetan tradition, for instance, Avalokiteshvara is the form in which Shakyamuni himself continues to work in the world. Not that Avalokiteshvara only appears at the time of the Buddha's death. Whatever in the Buddha we term Avalokiteshvara is there from the moment he is enlightened. But at the time of the Parinirvana, the physical body drops away, and only the Avalokiteshvara element is left, so to speak. This, broadly speaking, is the Mahayana view. Secondly, there are those bodhisattvas who are aspects or direct emanations of the Dharmakaya and have no previous human history. All these great and glorious figures embody one or another aspect of Buddhahood, and there are literally hundreds of them. In certain kinds of meditation, you visualize a blue sky free of clouds, and you imagine sacred circles, mandalas, containing hundreds, even thousands of these bodhisattvas, filling that infinite firmament. These bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya are at the very top of the whole bodhisattva hierarchy. Most of them, both male and female forms, are represented as being of slender, graceful appearance, with long flowing hair, and decorated with ornaments of gold, silver, and so on, symbolizing in all aspects of their appearance the beauty and richness of the Dharmakaya, its superabundant manifestations continually welling forth. Avalokiteshvara is among the most prominent of all these figures. His name means the Lord who looks down. And he is so called because he looks down on the world in compassion. He represents the compassionate aspect of enlightenment. Imagine a vast blue sky, a sky which is completely empty, nothing but blueness stretching to infinity. Then in that blue sky you see not even a face, just the barely visible lineaments of a compassionate smile. This is the compassion aspect of reality. This is Avalokiteshvara. Though, of course, where there is compassion, there must be wisdom. It is Avalokiteshvara who appears in the Heart Sutra, the heart of the perfection of wisdom. Iconographically, he is pure white in colour and carries lotus flowers, symbolizing spiritual rebirth. His face is alive with a sweet, compassionate smile. In some depictions of him, one foot is tucked up in the posture of meditation, showing that he is deep in dhyana, while the other foot hangs loose, showing his readiness to step down at any moment into the turmoil of the world to help living beings. As we have seen, for the bodhisattva, inner tranquility and external activity are not contradictory, but different aspects of the same thing. Altogether, there are 108 forms of Avalokiteshvara. One of the most famous is the 11-headed, thousand-armed form. To us, this is perhaps going to seem grotesque, but the symbolism is very interesting. It is said that once Avalokiteshvara was contemplating the sorrows of the world, the miseries of sentient beings, their suffering by fire, flood, famine, bereavement, separation, war, shipwreck, and so on. He was overwhelmed by such compassion that he wept, and went on weeping so violently we are told, that his head shivered into 11 fragments, each of which became a face. And there are 11 of them, because there are 11 directions of space. North, south, east, west, the four intermediate points, up and down, and the centre. And compassion looks in all directions simultaneously. Not only that, he has 1,000 arms. At least, iconographically, he is supposed to have 1,000 arms. In truth, the Bodhisattva of compassion has millions of arms, each of which is stretched out to help living beings in one way or another. With the help of this symbol, Buddhism tries to express the nature of compassion, that it looks in all directions and tries to help in all conceivable ways. Clearly, an archetypal Bodhisattva of this kind is not quite the same as an archetypal Buddha. While the Buddha of the Dharmakaya represents the ideal as realized outside space and time, the Bodhisattva represents the ideal in the process of realization within space and time. But just as, due to the limitations of the historical situation, the human historical Buddha cannot fully express what he has realized in his inner being, in the same way, the individual who is trying to be a Bodhisattva can't express the full nature of the Bodhisattva ideal, because the ideal has reference not just to that individual situation, but to all space and time. The figure of Avalokiteshvara, with 1,000 arms and 11 heads, expresses something of this. It wouldn't be possible for any one person in any given historical situation to do everything that is needed. But each individual can imbibe the spirit of the Bodhisattva and express that in their own way within their own life. The Bodhisattva's vow to help all beings throughout the universe is an expression of the Bodhisattva spirit. One does one's bit by helping those beings who fall within one's particular sphere of influence. One can aspire to be one of the 1,000 arms of Avalokiteshvara. Another of the Bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya is Manjugosha, who represents the wisdom aspect of enlightenment. He is a beautiful golden orange or tawny colour. His is the golden wisdom of enlightenment that dispels ignorance as the sun dispels the darkness, and he carries a sword and a book. The flaming sword in his right hand symbolises his wisdom. He whirls it above his head, cutting asunder the bonds of ignorance and of karma, all the knotty tangles that keep tripping us up. And the book he holds in his other hand is the perfection of wisdom, which he holds close to his heart. His legs are crossed in the meditation posture, because wisdom springs, as the Dhammapada teaches us, from meditation. Manjugosha is the patron deity of all the arts and sciences. If you want to write a book, paint a picture, or compose a piece of music, you traditionally invoke Manjugosha, and his mantra is repeated for retentive memory, understanding of the Dharma, eloquence, power of speech, and so on. Then there is Vajrapani, who represents the power aspect of enlightenment. Not power in the political sense, or in the sense of power over other people, but spiritual power. Although he has a peaceful form too, Vajrapani is usually depicted in wrathful form, an image of furious energy to crush the forces of ignorance. The wrathful Vajrapani is dark blue in colour, and he is not slim, slender or graceful, but has a stout body, protuberant belly and thick, short limbs. His countenance expresses extreme anger, and he has long white teeth or tusks. He is more or less naked, apart from ornaments of human bone and a tiger skin, and he carries in one hand a vajra, a thunderbolt, with which he destroys the forces of ignorance. This terrifying figure is crowned with 5 skulls representing the 5 wisdoms. One foot is uplifted, to crush and trample all the forces of conditioned existence that separate us from the light of truth, and he is surrounded by a great halo of flames. This is the Bodhisattva Vajrapani, destroying and breaking up conditioned existence, rending the veil of ignorance, and scattering all the forces of darkness through the power of his spiritual energy. Then, by way of contrast, there is Tara, who appears in female form. This does not mean that she is a female Bodhisattva, just as it would not be correct to say that Manjugosha is a male Bodhisattva. Bodhisattvas have gone far beyond distinctions of male and female. Some appear in male form, others in female form, others now in one, now the other. Tara is the spiritual daughter of Avalokiteshvara. She is usually either white or green in colour, and according to another beautiful legend, she was born from the tears of Avalokiteshvara as he wept over the sorrows of existence. In the midst of a great pool of tears, there appeared a white lotus. The lotus opened, and there was Tara, the very essence, indeed the quintessence of compassion. Often she bears a blue or white lotus flower, and in her white form she has seven eyes. Two ordinary eyes, plus a third in the forehead, two in the palms of her hands and two in the soles of her feet. There is nothing blind, sentimental or foolish about compassion. It is informed by awareness, mindfulness and knowledge. Sometimes what passes for compassion is really no more than pity, and it just makes things worse. There is a saying that it takes all the wisdom of the wise to undo the harm done by the merely good, and one could add, the harm done by the merely pitying. If there is one more archetypal bodhisattva to be mentioned along with the key figures so described, it is Vajrasattva. He represents purity, not physical purity, moral purity, or even spiritual purity, not any purity that can be attained. Vajrasattva represents primeval purity, the original spotless purity of the mind, unsoiled and untouched from beginningless ages. We cannot purify the mind through spiritual practice. We may purify the lower mind, because the lower mind can become soiled, but we can never purify the ultimate mind, because the ultimate mind never becomes impure. We purify ourselves truly by waking up to the fact that we have never been impure, that we were pure all the time. This ultimately inherent purity of the mind, above and beyond time, above and beyond the possibility of impurity, is represented by Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva is pure, dazzling white, like sunlight reflecting from snow. He is sometimes depicted completely naked, and sometimes is wearing the silks and jewels of a bodhisattva. His mantra, which has 100 syllables, is recited and meditated upon to purify one's faults, or rather to purify oneself of the impurity of thinking that one is not intrinsically pure. There are many, many bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya, but these few must suffice by way of illustration. All of them are, in the last analysis, simply different aspects of our own fundamentally enlightened mind, our own immanent Buddha mind. One could say that all the bodhisattvas are one bodhisattva. We speak of Avalokiteshvara, Manjugosha and so on, but we must not think of them as being literally distinct supernatural personalities, up there or in some other world. They are all different ways of looking at one and the same bodhisattva, one and the same spiritual power at work in the universe. In principle, there is no reason why new bodhisattva forms should not emerge in the context of Western Buddhism, as has happened and continues to happen in other Buddhist cultures. In the Vajrayana tradition, which continues to this day, new bodhisattva forms, or at least new Dharmapala and Dakini forms, have emerged comparatively late within that tradition, usually being recognized as a new form of an existing bodhisattva. In Japan, for example, bodhisattvas emerged from amongst the indigenous deities, taking on their characteristic features. One of these Japanese divinities, absorbed into the Japanese Buddhist pantheon, was Hachiman, who originally had some phallic significance, but came to be regarded as a form of Avalokiteshvara. However, this tidy designation within the existing pantheon cannot hide the fact that he represents the emergence within Japanese Mahayana Buddhism of a quite distinctive bodhisattva form, which has its origins in the Japanese psyche. A similar thing happened with Acala, a figure of Indian origin, who assumed a distinctive Japanese form. Dressed in just a loincloth, he is heavily muscled, with a lock of hair hanging down on his forehead, like that worn by Japanese wrestlers, and glaring, bulging eyes. He carries a noose and is accompanied by two small boys, whose significance is obscure, but who seem to be assistants of some kind. He is associated with mountains and waterfalls, natural settings where some of his Japanese devotees live as hermits and practice austerities. His appearance is quite grim, but he is said to be very kind. All in all, he is a distinctively Japanese bodhisattva, a specific product of the Japanese psyche or collective unconscious. It is likewise to be expected that bodhisattvas will take on different forms in the West, because people will perceive and experience them differently. We will probably need to start off with the traditional Eastern iconography, but at the same time we have to realize that so far as we are concerned, those forms may not look in the least like the bodhisattvas whose names they bear. In discussing the representation of Apollo in Greek and modern neoclassical art, the 19th century art critic Ruskin says that because people are acquainted with, for example, the form of Apollo Belvedere, they think they know what Apollo looks like. But he says they don't really know this at all. They only know what the statue of Apollo looks like, quite a different thing. Similarly, we may think we know what Buddhist archetypal figures like Manjugosha or Tara look like, but all we really know is how these figures are represented in medieval Indian and Tibetan art. Such depictions may give some clue to what those bodhisattvas are, but not necessarily. Sooner or later, we have to work our way from the traditional appearance of a bodhisattva to what that appearance is meant to represent. For example, what of the beautiful golden colour of Manjugosha, his uplifted fiery sword, and so on, to do with Manjugosha as a spiritual entity? Can we take it that Manjugosha does literally look like that? In a sense, yes, but in another sense, certainly not. One has to put aside the traditional iconography and ask oneself, what is Manjugosha? What is the reality behind this term, Manjugosha? What do I experience? What is conjured up before me when I speak the name of Manjugosha? It could be that nothing at all is conjured up. Perhaps one knows the form of the iconography, but hasn't felt one's way through it to the reality it represents. One may know what a statue of Apollo looks like, but this does not mean that one will necessarily have the slightest feeling for what Apollo represents to a sensitive Greek. In the same way, one may have read all about Manjugosha and know how he is represented without having any feeling for what he represents to a sensitive Tibetan devotee. Having got a definite feeling for what can only be called the Manjugosha principle, as distinct from any particular traditional form, one then has to ask oneself what the principle would look like if it took form. One has to build up or create the form out of one's experience or realization of the principle. Trying to do this will give one a much truer vision of what, in a manner of speaking, Manjugosha looks like. After all, the traditional iconography is only a stepping stone. and it may be very far removed from somebody's actual experience. The artist may have represented Manjugosha according to tradition, but he will not necessarily have had any feeling for what the form represents. One might have to go back 15 or 20 generations of artists to come to someone who saw Manjugosha on a visionary level or had a genuine feeling for him. If one is engaging with these forms as part of one's Buddhist practice, one will sooner or later need to try to create or perceive them independently with one's own imaginal faculty. It is rather like going to meet someone, as distinct from looking at a photograph. The photograph does give us a rough idea what they look like, but meeting them is a completely different experience. It may be, in any case, that traditional Buddhist iconography leaves one completely cold, in which case one will have to find some other way of connecting with what it symbolises, perhaps via the symbolism of Western art. It is a matter of gradually drawing one's feelings into one's exploration of these symbols and finding connections where one can. It isn't a rational process. Even if one discovers that one does have a strong feeling for Apollo, to use that example, one can't just say, "I've got this strong feeling for Apollo and now I'm going to try to transfer it to Manjugosha." One has to see some glimmer of Manjugosha in Apollo. One has to have some sense of some real connection. It may be a good idea to try connecting more with the mythical level of things in general. To begin with, one may have to explore literature and the arts quite widely, especially if one hasn't paid much attention to this aspect of life before. As one explores, one should gradually discover certain images, symbols, or myths that affect one more powerfully and positively than others. For instance, you might find yourself fascinated, although you might not understand why, by the figure of the unicorn. So you read up about unicorns and collect copies of pictures and tapestries in which they are depicted. Being careful not to smother your interest in merely academic study, you try to understand why the unicorn has that sort of appeal for you, and at the same time you try to intensify that feeling. Connections like this can be clues that lead one to the realm of archetypal form, of which the bodhisattvas are especially sublime representatives. By their very nature as ideals, the bodhisattvas of the Dharmakaya represent for us a far-off goal. All we can do is form a resolute intention to traverse the immeasurable distance that separates us from those brilliant images. This intention establishes one as a novice bodhisattva and can be publicly acknowledged and celebrated in the form of the ceremony of the bodhisattva ordination. The ordination has two parts: the taking of the bodhisattva vow, usually in the form of the four great vows, and the acceptance of the bodhisattva precepts. Different lists of these precepts are to be found in the Mahayana scriptures, and they express a more specific, more detailed application of the great vows. The taking of the bodhisattva vow as part of the bodhisattva ordination corresponds on its higher level to the going for refuge, and the acceptance of the bodhisattva precepts corresponds to the taking of the 5 or 10 ordinary precepts. The bodhisattva ordination is not just a ceremony. It is the natural expression of the arising of the will to enlightenment, and as such, it ideally takes place in the first bhumi. But as a ceremony, it may be taken by the novice bodhisattva. That is, one can take the bodhisattva ordination in anticipation, as it were, of the arising of the bodhicitta. The taking of the bodhisattva ordination can therefore be included among the conditions in dependence upon which the bodhicitta arises. This, at any rate, is the way it is viewed in Tibetan Buddhism. One usually takes the bodhisattva precepts in much the same way that one might perform the sevenfold puja, as a means of assisting the arising of the bodhicitta. The bodhisattva ordination has come to mean a public acceptance of the bodhisattva ideal regardless of whether or not the bodhicitta has arisen. It reflects what used to happen when someone met the Buddha. They would hear him teach, their Dharma eye would open, or, to put it another way, the bodhicitta would arise, and they would spontaneously say, "To the Buddha for refuge I go." Taking the vow, in a sense, reenacts that scene in such a way as to encourage the arising of the bodhicitta. Thus, we can speak of going for refuge effectively as a means of stimulating the real going for refuge. In the same way, the bodhisattva ordination and the taking of vows in Mahayana Buddhist countries today takes place on the provisional or effective level as a means to the achievement of the real arising of the bodhicitta. At the time of my own bodhisattva ordination, I took the bodhisattva precepts, but I didn't make any vows. I considered that I had quite enough on my plate when I took those precepts. My teacher, Yogi Chen, made the point very strongly that having taken the bodhisattva ordination, one should formulate one's own vows. And he himself had formulated a number of sets of them, but I never felt, myself, that I could venture to formulate any such vows. It seemed to me that the precepts, together with the general statement, "I resolve to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all beings," were enough to be getting on with. It must be emphasized that the bodhisattva ordination does not confer any spiritual status. Spiritual status, in fact, cannot be conferred. It doesn't even imply a recognition of spiritual status. If one takes the bodhisattva ordination, it represents a public pledge on one's own part that one will do one's best to live up to the bodhisattva ideal. Public here, meaning in the presence of the Buddhist spiritual community. There is certainly no guarantee that the bodhicitta is going to arise at that time. It is always difficult to know if the bodhicitta has or hasn't arisen in a particular individual. However, whether or not the bodhicitta has arisen, whether or not we are ready to take the bodhisattva ordination, whether or not we can consider ourselves even to be novice bodhisattvas, we can all contemplate, at least from afar, the glories of the bodhisattva hierarchy.